The headlines: a high-ranking Taliban official says discussions are underway in Doha about a future Afghan government, including its structure and name. Military flights evacuating diplomats and civilians from Afghanistan resume after Kabul airport was cleared of people desperate to flee the Taliban takeover of the capital. And the U.S. criticizes Iran for producing 20% enriched uranium metal, which Tehran says is needed for its research reactor. Thanks for joining us. A senior Taliban official says talks are underway in Qatar about a future Afghan government, including its name and structure. The Taliban's political deputy leader, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, said the talks are taking place in Doha. He said the Taliban delegates are there and are in contact with international community and political parties within Afghanistan. Meanwhile, inside the country, the Taliban have declared a general amnesty for all government officials, urging them to return to work. The group took over Afghanistan on Sunday after it captured the capital. Kabul's takeover followed the capturing of other key cities by the Taliban in the course of a week. Military flights have resumed, evacuating foreign diplomats and civilians from the Afghan capital, Kabul. The resumption comes after Kabul airport was cleared of people desperate to flee the Taliban takeover of the capital. On Monday, the airport saw chaotic scenes in which U.S. forces fired at crowds to make way for American military transport planes to take off. At least five people died on the runway. The Taliban took control of Kabul on Sunday without a fight. Amin Alam is our correspondent who joins us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Update us on the latest, if you can, Amin. And, of course, we're looking at talks that are taking place in Doha, from what we understand. I'm sure there are major topics being discussed and decisions that are being made there.
Well, according to Taliban sources, the group's spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, is going to attend a press conference today and share the latest developments regarding to the group's achievements and the group's plan to bring control the entire city of Kabul as the capital of Afghanistan. In the meantime, the situation inside the city seems to be calm. There are several security checkposts, and we can see dozens of Taliban members who are inside the city that are patrolling with military vehicles, including U.S. Tanks and army and police fighters. In the meantime, some supermarkets are still closed, but the people are slowly resuming their normal life. This comes as the Taliban have already called and asked the people of Afghanistan, particularly the residents of Kabul, to not be scared and resume their normal life. However, it was also scheduled that a group of three high top Afghan politicians will go to the Qatari capital Doha, but the this trip was postponed due to unknown reasons. The former Afghan president Hamid Karzai, the former head of High Reconciliation Council Abdullah Abdullah, and the head of Hizb-e Islami Gulbuddin Hikmatyar were the members of this delegation who had planned to meet the Taliban leadership in the Qatari capital Doha and discuss with them about the establishment of the new government. However, the viewpoints or the stance of former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, as well as the rest of two other members of this negotiation team, comes as the Taliban had already insisted that the only legitimate government in Afghanistan will be the Islamic Emirate.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Amin Alami, their correspondent from Kabul. U.S. President Joe Biden has defended his decision to withdraw troops from the country, Afghanistan. He acknowledged that the country's mission made many missteps.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. What's happening now could just as easily happen 5 years ago. or 15 years in the future. We have to be honest. Our mission in Afghanistan has taken many missteps, made many missteps over the past two decades.
In a live address, Biden also said the U.S. mission in country was never supposed to be a nation building. He said the Afghan government collapsed more quickly than expected. He blamed the Taliban's takeover on Afghan political leaders who fled the country, while the army surrendered to the militant group without a fight. Elsewhere in his remarks, Biden warned the Taliban not to disrupt or threaten the evacuation of American diplomats and Afghan translators at Kabul Airport. The U.S. president underlined that the response to any attack would be, quote, swift and forceful. Biden has faced a barrage of criticism over his handling of the U.S. withdrawal. Political commentator Frank M. Speck says the U.S. approach to fighting the Taliban has been defective all along.
Most people in this country don't think the war was a good idea and want to get out. Now, the Republicans are already attacking him on he didn't do the withdrawal correctly, and it looks like Saigon, and so on and so forth. I don't think that's going to work very well. The fundamental issue is we're getting out. But what is missing from President Biden and almost every single commentator here is that there's a political issue. This is one of the first times that the word civil war has been enunciated by anybody in leadership. In fact, no army can collapse the way the Afghan army did if they actually had anybody in it who believed in fighting for the government. Instead, we have a kleptocracy here, or did, and everybody knew they were getting paid off and the soldiers weren't being paid and so forth. The fact that our method of trying to fight the Taliban was to incite a civil war, it just shows how bankrupt that whole political line was and is, both in Afghanistan and wherever we do it next.
Islamabad is cautious on recognizing the Taliban as the leaders of Afghanistan after the group recaptured the war-torn country with little resistance. Pakistan, which shares a 2,700-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, however, has reopened most of its border crossings with its neighboring country. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Afghan politicians and officials who fled from Kabul to Islamabad hours before the Taliban took over the capital. Afghanistan is now under the control of the Taliban, who are in a consultation process to form a new government. It remains unclear whether the Taliban would include other ethnic groups in their rule or they would form their own exclusive government. The Taliban recaptured the whole Afghanistan, most of which without any resistance, after Afghan National Army surrendered to the group. Pakistan has assured visiting Afghan leaders that it would support an inclusive government representing all ethnic Afghan groups. Pakistan's National Security Council had an emergency meeting to review the impact of Taliban's takeover on Pakistan. Islamabad also discussed its options on whether or not to recognize the new government in Afghanistan.
Pakistan will not take any decision in haste about the recognition of new government. It will definitely take a collective decision, the decision which will be made by China, which will be made by Iran, which will be made by Russia. There are reports that China and Russia and other countries would recognize. Pakistan will immediately follow the step the moment China recognizes the new regime.
The Taliban's recapture of Afghanistan has shocked the world, given the lightning speed with which they took over the war-ravaged country even before the full withdrawal of U.S.-led NATO forces. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has been critical of U.S. for messing up with Afghanistan.
Mental enslavement is worse than physical enslavement. It is more difficult to break the shackles of enslavement of mind. But people in Afghanistan have broken the chains of mental enslavement by forcing the U.S. to exit.
Pakistan is now dealing with the Taliban as a de facto government of Afghanistan, and that is why Islamabad has reopened almost all crossing points with Afghanistan, given the fact that there are tens of thousands of people who make back and forth movements on the both sides of the borders. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The UK Prime Minister is recalling the country's parliament next week to debate the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, precipitated by the withdrawal of British and American troops. While some have called the withdrawal a massive foreign policy disaster, others have described it a betrayal of the Afghan people. Syed Burza has more from London.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union. You know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others, they brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, you know, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban back in power 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Syed Burza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has verified Iran has produced uranium metal up to 20% purity for its research reactor. The IAEA report shows the production of 200 grams of uranium material. Tehran has already announced that it was researching uranium metal in order to provide advanced fuel for its research reactor. The U.S. has reacted to the report, claiming that Iran has, quote, no credible need to produce uranium metal. The Islamic Republic began scaling down its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal, 1 year after the U.S. pulled out of it and reimposed sanctions on the country. Iran and the remaining signatories have held several rounds of talks on the revival of the deal. However, talks have made no breakthrough due to excessive U.S. demands. Tehran wants the U.S. to remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner and to assure that it won't leave the deal again. Japan is set to expand its coronavirus restrictions as cases surge in the capital, Tokyo, and elsewhere. Curbs will include extending the state of emergency in worst-hit areas by nearly 2 weeks to September 12. The emergency restrictions will also expand to cover almost 60% of Japan's population. On Monday, Tokyo announced nearly 3,000 new infections in 24 hours. The city on Friday also registered a record high of around 5,800 daily cases. The new measures are expected to cost Japan's economy nearly $11 billion and claim 66,000 jobs. The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has hailed as a hopeful start a first round of talks with the country's opposition aimed at settling political and economic problems.
It has got off to a successful, hopeful start. We are going to do everything impossible, so that the opposition does not kick down the table, so that this time the opposition does not break the path of dialogue.
He was speaking after preliminary meetings in Mexico, mediated by Norway. Maduro said the opposition has agreed to put an end to what he called conspiracies and to respect Venezuela's independence and peace. He also expressed hope for direct dialogue with the U.S., saying the return of ambassadors with the U.S. could be on the table during the talks. The lifting of U.S. and European sanctions and guarantees for fair elections were among issues discussed in Mexico City. In a joint statement, the two sides agreed to meet again in the first week of September, but did not disclose the venue. As Palestinian children get back to school with the beginning of the new educational year in the Gaza Strip, a number of students have to stay at home because of injuries that they sustained during Israel's recent onslaught on the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabit has more.
While the new educational year has started in the Gaza Strip, the 9-year-old Mohammed Shaban can't get back to school as he has lost his sight in an Israeli airstrike in Beit Lahia during the latest escalation over the Gaza Strip.
Today was the first day of the new educational year in Gaza, and Mohammed asked me to take him to school. I couldn't tell him that he can't go due to his injury. Mohammed used to do many things before he lost his sight. Now I try to help him play and move, but it is very hard. I remember when they hit our neighboring areas and I couldn't find Mohammed. I went to Gaza's main hospital and found him there. I was terrified because I thought he was killed. Mohammed lost his sight in that airstrike completely.
Mohammed was with his mother buying clothes when the Israeli airplanes hit them, causing his sight loss. He was supposed to return to school and buy a uniform like other children, but due to his injury, he is not attending the new semester as he needs special care.
Mohammed was in the market with his mother to buy clothes for aid when the Israeli airstrike targeted the market. He sustained injury in his eyes. I took him to Egypt to have surgery, but unfortunately, he lost his sight and there is no treatment for him. This is all because of the Israeli crimes against us. Human rights groups should hold the Israeli regime accountable for my son's misery.
During the Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip, more than 200 people were killed, including children and women. Hundreds of children were injured, including many who have lost their body organs, amid the silence of the international community.
During the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip, more than 60 Palestinian children were killed and almost 500 others injured. Israeli regime intends to target children and deprive them of their basic human rights. We call on the international communities to put Israel on the blacklist.
The last thing Mohammed had seen was the Israeli bombing that costed him his sight, depriving him and many other children from returning to school and causing them permanent disabilities. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
And that does it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. In today's program, we'll be listening to Imam's expose of the enemy's plots to separate other colonized countries from their indigenous culture and make them dependent on the West or East. Please stay with us.
Imam
during the post-Second World War years because of the formation of the bipolar world order and a new equation known as the Cold War. Nearly all countries were forced to be a member of either the Western or the Eastern Bloc. The Western Bloc was led by the United States of America, and the Eastern Bloc was led by the former Soviet Union. Concurrent with the intensification of anti-colonialist struggles throughout the world, a number of Asian and African countries decided to adopt an independent policy to get rid of the two blocks of power. Iran was among the pioneers of this approach. With the nationalization of the oil industry in the country, the hands of Britain were cut off from Iran's oil reserves. This measure turned into a role model for other colonized nations to follow. In fact, in 1955, the first conference of Asian African countries was held in the Indonesian city of Bandung to set up the new bloc known as the Non-Aligned Movement. Iran's representative in the Bandung Conference in Indonesia was Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. His adopting of a negative balance policy showed a practical pattern for freedom seekers in the world. After the British-American coup d'etat in August of 1953, Iran's despotic Shah changed the foreign policy to complete dependence on the West, especially the United States of America. As he owned his throne to the Americans, he became an official member of the Western Bloc and granted myriads of concessions to Washington in the economic, political, and military domains. Hence, the despotic Shah created an atmosphere of suffocation and dictatorship in the country. The Shah destroyed people's civil freedoms and changed the constitutional rule to authoritarian and despotic kingdom. Thus, no opposition group or no opposition voice was allowed to be active in the country. While Iran was ruled by the dictatorial Pahlavi regime, Imam Khomeini staged his unique revolution to revive Islam and bring back the country's independence and dignity, which had been trampled upon by Western regimes, particularly the United States. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, succeeded to turn independence into one of the main axes of the Islamic revolution's discourse, through the motto, "Neither East nor West, Islam is the best." Hence, this slogan became the guide for Iran's foreign policy. Of course, this motto doesn't mean to sever relations with other nations. Rather, it means to sever all colonialist ties with the blocks of power and keeping the national sovereignty through reciprocal respect for other nations. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to emphasize on this principle throughout his life. In his testament, too, he referred to the enemy's efforts to destroy national self-confidence and make them colonies of the big powers. Imam Khomeini wrote, "Among the schemes that unfortunately had a great impact on countries and our dear country and its impacts have remained to a great extent is to make the colonized countries alienated with themselves and make them westernized or easternized. Thus, they trivialize themselves and their culture and power, and considered the West and the East as superior race, deemed their culture as loftier and the two powers as the Qibla of the world, and called dependence on one of the poles of power as an inevitable obligation." The story of this sad thing is long, and the blows that we have received by it and are still receiving are fatal and grinding. And what is more doleful is that they kept the oppressed nations backward in everything and brought them up as consumer countries, and so much scared us of their own progress and satanic powers so that we dare not to embark on anything and have surrendered all we have to them and have ceded our fate and our countries to them and are totally obedient to them. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that blind imitation of the West or the East and passivity against foreigners are the most important impacts of dependence upon them. He wrote in his testament, "This artificial absurdity and empty-headedness has caused us not to rely on our thoughts and knowledge in anything, and simply to imitate the East or the West blindly. Even if we had any innovation in culture, literature and industry, the Westernized and Easternized would castigate and ridicule them, and they repress and disappoint our native thought and power, and through speech and writing promote foreign customs and traditions, no matter how mean and scandalous they are, and sell them to nations by extolling them. I recommend the dear nations sympathetically and humbly that, now that they have been relieved of many of these traps to a great extent, the deprived generation is ready for activity and has stood up. We saw that many factories and advanced tools such as aeroplanes and other industrial goods which were never thought to be put into work by Iranian specialists. We had extended all hands towards the West or East so that the specialists and experts would launch them. But due to economic siege and the imposed war, our younger generation themselves have made the needed parts and supplied them at lower costs and met the demand. The younger generation have proved that if we want, we certainly can. You should be watchful, wakeful and careful so that politicians who are dependent on the West or the East may not drag you towards these international plunderers via satanic schemes, and stand up with firm will and perseverance to remove dependence."
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. The Taliban has now taken control of Afghanistan. What the U.S. couldn't do in 20 years, the Taliban did in a matter of days. Why did Afghanistan fall to the Taliban at warp speed? And furthermore, why didn't the Afghan army put up a resistance and fight, especially in Kabul? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will ask all of those questions from our guests and look at what it means for the country, its neighbors, and the world. First, let's get the latest. We cross on over to Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, to talk to Amin Alami. Okay, Amin, at this point, lots of developments have occurred in the country today. Tell us the highlights of what has occurred, especially some of the, I guess, statements that came from the emergency session of the UN Security Council.
Of course, following the Taliban capture of the Afghan capital, Kabul, and declared that the war in Afghanistan is over, many regional and international bodies, including the United Nations, expressed their concern about the possible violation of human rights, women's rights, and many other similar issues in Afghanistan under the rule of Taliban over this country. Since the Taliban appeared inside the city of Kabul, people of Afghanistan were scared during the first moments and even during the first day of their presence here in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Later on the day and even all over the night, hundreds of Afghans rushed into Kabul International Airport. As a result of an stampede, at least five individuals lost their lives, and as there were too much crowded, American forces also shoot it on air and called the people who had rushed into the Kabul International Airport to be away from the military aircrafts that were inside the Kabul International Military Airport. In the meantime, the UN Security Council and the recent emergency meeting on Afghanistan also shows that There is an international concern regarding to the fate of Afghanistan, regarding to what is called the achievement of the people of Afghanistan over the past 20 years, including the press freedom, social society freedom, as well as women rights freedom and other issues related to human rights. But, however, inside Afghanistan, many have also urged the Taliban to pay respect to the demands of Afghan people, honor their basic rights, and allow especially girls and women to do their basic works and resume their normal life in order to have a right to go to schools, go to universities, be an artist, or similar issues. In the meantime, some top political leaders of Afghanistan are going to go to the Qatari capital, Doha, in order to meet the leadership of Taliban there. Hamid Karzai, the former Afghan president, Abdullah, the former High Council, National Reconciliation Council for Afghanistan, are two members of this delegation. Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who is the leader of Hizbi Islami, is also another member of this delegation who are going to visit capital Doha. All these three members of this delegation have insisted on their strong will to find a solution for the Afghan conflict as a result of direct talks with the leadership of the Taliban in the Qatari capital Doha. For instance, Hamid Karzai optimistically said on a video message that was shared on social media that we are committed to bring peace in Afghanistan and we are in direct contact with the leaders of the Taliban either inside Afghanistan or abroad, mainly in the Qatari capital Doha. But let's not forget that the Taliban seems to behave something in different ways against what they had done 20 years ago in Afghanistan during their rule over Afghanistan. For instance, they are trying to be kind, to be friendly with locals inside the cities, and they have assured the people of Afghanistan, especially the residents of Kabul, to be inside their houses and get out for their works, and even they called on the employees of the Afghan government, the military employees and the non-military employees of the Afghan government to get back to their offices. However, there are also some unconfirmed reports that the Taliban have in some cases gone to the doors of some residents of Kabul, mainly the military employees of the Afghan government, especially the Afghan pilots who were working in the Afghan Air Force. But the Taliban sources has not commented regarding to this issue so far. In the meantime, the people of the residents of Kabul want an assurance, further guarantee, in order to resume their normal life in Afghanistan. However, they also blame the international community, mainly the United States of Afghanistan, for failing to achieve its stated goals and its promises to the people of Afghanistan, mainly bringing stability and peace to this country.
Thank you very much for that, Amin Ali. We appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have writer, blogger, social activist, and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Sayed Muaz Shah, who joins us from Karachi. Also joining us, publisher and editor at Politics First, Marcus Papadopoulos, who joins us from London. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Sayed Muaz Shah. We're very curious, along with the rest of the world, as to why we saw the downfall of Afghanistan, especially when it came to the lack of resistance from the Afghan army, and how quickly the Taliban was able to take over the country. You know, that's a big question mark when put into the context that the U.S. was there for 20 years, and one of the core missions that they had was to train the Afghan army. Is it because of that failure, or is it something else?
I think it's a little bit deeper than that. And I think we have to look at, when we talk about the morale or vision behind why someone fights, and I think it's as basic as that. So when we talk about the Kabul regime that was there, one of the main key aspects, as you hinted, was a lot of U.S. money and funding, and some estimates put it at almost $450 million on an annual basis. So where you have that flow of money and sustainability through funds, you have to ask yourself, you have to go ask the soldier who's fighting, what is he fighting for? What is that vision? Whereas if you look at the case in Taliban, you know, their fighters are not getting paid. Essentially, they're volunteers of local. And they've sold the idea and the vision that they are fighting for their country to get it back from occupiers. And I think that's one of the most centralized themes that we have kind of glaze over, but it's the morale. And if you ask any military expert, they'll tell you that the morale of an army is very important. And so what's happened was, when the Americans had lifted their hand of support earlier this year, you quickly had seen a sort of helplessness in the ranks. There was some resistance, but there wasn't that vision there, that there was that essence of the American essence disappearing. And there's a feeling that the money's going to disappear and the stability is going to disappear, and that's what the stability depended on. And we can criticize, you know, those people can criticize America shouldn't have left yet, they should have, you know, done more, waited till it was more stable. But the reality is that, what is that vision? I mean, if we look at the current, the Kabul regime structure, it was, you know, 18% reported voter turnout. Is that truly a representation of the people of Afghanistan? Were they all involved in that process? And the people who were in power understood that. And that's one of the things why they were kind of skeptical about involving the Taliban in the talks much earlier, because they were afraid of losing power because of where the Taliban strongholds were. They might get outvoted in a, you know, voting booth. So that was also a concern that eventually, you know, kind of fell out because of the Doha Accords. So they had to come to the table anyways, because the American support was evaporating. So I think the key thing I would say is morale and the vision that was sold. And that's something that the Taliban definitely fed on. They definitely fed on the historical experience of the Afghanistani people, from what the British had done earlier, then the Russians. And that was something similar that in this scenario, that they also sold that vision. And I think that was extremely important in how they convinced. And of course, some of the miscalculations that the U.S. and Afghan forces did with the Bagram Air Base, and we know the horrors and torture issues that came out of there, and including the raids on people's houses. So I think that definitely fell more in their favor and only increased their momentum, and we've seen it unfold just a few days ago.
Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, if what our guest there is saying, if you agree with, it's just another way that this war was misrepresented, because we know that the U.S. misrepresented the war to the world, but in particular also to the American people. At this point, you know, this war has been called a colossal failure for the U.S., and basically you have the allies that have condemned the U.S. over this botched, as they call, end to the 20-year NATO campaign. You have, for example, a leading German politician that says it's the biggest debacle in the alliance's history. Do you see this as being that?
Can I first of all say that I cannot praise Press TV highly enough for its professional and insightful coverage of the situation in Afghanistan. And I would also like to take this opportunity to condemn the appallingly useless coverage of developments in Afghanistan by British mainstream media, whose reporters and columnists from outlets such as The Telegraph, The Guardian, and Sky News have clearly demonstrated that their knowledge of Afghanistan is largely drawn from Wikipedia, and that their only expertise is narcissism, attention-seeking, and seeking Pulitzer Prizes. Now, in regard to the Taliban's conquest of Afghanistan, the ease in which the Taliban was able to conquer Afghanistan, to easily defeat the Afghan army, gives rise to serious suspicion, in my estimation. Serious suspicion that the Americans and the British have arrived at an informal agreement with the Taliban, because the Taliban's victory was so easy, too easy. It was truly startling. The Taliban was able to conquer parts of Afghanistan where it traditionally had never received considerable support. And history tells us that the Americans and the British only retreat from a country of geostrategic importance, if they are defeated on the battlefield. So, for example, the American military was defeated in Vietnam by the North Vietnamese military and by the Viet Cong, hence why the Americans withdrew. But the American military and the British military was not defeated by the Taliban. And at the same time, the American and the British military did not defeat the Taliban as well. So that is why I believe that the Americans and the British have not withdrawn from Afghanistan. Yes, their soldiers have withdrawn, but American and British influence and control in countries around the world is more than just a military one. I believe that the future is this, that the Taliban have evolved. The Taliban is no longer what it was during the 1990s and going into 2000 and 2001. I believe the Taliban understand that if they are to safeguard their dominance in Afghanistan, then they have to change. But at the same time, the Americans and the British look to the Taliban as an organization that they can do business with, so to speak, concerning the opium trade, but also threatening, for instance, Central Asia, which of course is Russia's backyard. And the Americans and the British can use the Taliban to cause problems in Central Asia, such as Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan, in the hope that terrorism will spread rapidly into Central Asia and will then enter Russia. So, in short, I do not believe the Americans and the British have truly left Afghanistan.
Okay. Well, let's then break this angle open, because that's worthy of elaborating on it. And if you agree with that, Sayyid Muaz Shah, that puts a different viewpoint onto the way that our guest mentioned the U.S. and the U.K. militarily not to be in the country, however, possibly to put some weight in terms of, as our guest there said, do business with the Taliban to perhaps maneuver the group against Russia, maneuver the group inside the West Asia region, maybe against China, maybe against Iran. Do you think that those are possibilities?
Well, that's an interesting perspective, and I wouldn't rule that out, because as you can see, the Taliban has been very open about stating that we would like to have international relations, we would like to have international trade, and there's a lot of focus on that. They're basically trying to illustrate that we are not going to be isolationist as we were before. Not to mention that the Americans had dealings with the Taliban even before 2001, and we know that, you know, there was a lot of even business deals, and Taliban representatives even came over and visited the United States in the 90s. So we know that that space is there to potentially explore. But I think I would like to go back to the speech that Biden gave last month. And if you remember, on July 4th, he was getting a lot of questions on Afghanistan and finally held a press conference explaining the American position. And he said verbatim in his speech that, you know, this is the graveyard of empires. And he reiterated the reflection about what happened to the British and the Russians. And he said this is not going to be any different for us. So I'd kind of take Marcus's comment and kind of take it one step further, as he said that they haven't, you know, the place that they've retreated from is where they have been defeated. And here they had seen an inevitable defeat. So unless they would get something out of it, they would not. And I think I would give credit more to the British than the Americans, because they're very skilled at this, which is called they managed decline. And the British Empire has been able to kind of do that more successfully, whereas the Americans are more younger in this approach. So possibly, yes, there is space for that. But I see that whenever the backstep that is made, because the Americans were kind of really involved in Afghanistan, that's allowed the space to open up and allow other characters come at play. And we know another country that's taken a backstep in the Afghanistan situation is India. and that's because of certain dynamics on the ground. So now this vacuum, you see the Chinese and the Russians, they openly declared, hey, our embassies are going to be open. We're still going to be issuing visas, business as normal. The Pakistanis also themselves, they've said that, declared it today. So you have certain people where, you know, consulates and embassies are closing down for the United States and India and some other nations. And here, UN is also kind of securing its staff. So we're in a really kind of volatile situation. And as Marcus says, no one was honestly expecting it this rapid. I mean, I just like to take the timeline just a little bit back before Sunday. You remember, on Friday in Doha, they were having a meeting between Pakistan, United States, the United Kingdom, Russia, China, and then the Afghan representative came in late into that meeting. They had some discussion on Saturday. If you remember, there was an open announcement that we're sending back 3,600 troops. For what? To secure the embassy and the retreat and the exit. Why would you take the soldiers out and then bring them back? And so clearly, I felt that that was the message that they were saying, that maybe they were going to kind of do this last-minute gasp effort. And I think that sped up the Taliban situation, frankly. And that night, Jalalabad and those surrounding areas of Kabul fell, and we woke up Sunday morning, and what do you know? Lo and behold, they surrounded Kabul. So I think that was, I think, unprecedented and unexpected on all levels, even with the Taliban. I don't think they were even expecting this rapid of a collapse.
Okay, since we're just fresh out of time, my last question goes to you, Marcus Papadopoulos. Many countries, including the U.S., very concerned about the fact that Afghanistan may turn out to be or become a hotbed for terrorists and a breeding ground for terrorists. And I'm going to forge that question into what the Taliban has said and what you referred to, I believe, and that is the fact that the Taliban is showing a different face than what it was back in the 90s in order to get that international recognition, which it has now with some countries like, I don't want to use the word recognition, but we know that Russia and, for example, China are open and receptive now towards the Taliban. Do you think that the Taliban will allow Afghanistan to be a terrorist hotspot, or will it go the route for the international recognition part in order to make sure that the country at least stays stable and secure?
Well, the Taliban has clearly learned from its mistakes of the past. The Taliban clearly understands in 2021 the importance of public relations. Nonetheless, the Taliban still adheres to an extremist ideology. And even though the Russians and the Chinese embassies remain open in Kabul, that is for the time being. The Taliban has not simply did not simply disappear following the American invasion of Afghanistan nearly 20 years ago. We know that the Americans and the British were, on the one hand, fighting against the Taliban, but on the other, they were talking with them. And the most important aspect of that is the latter. What were they talking with them about? And it is very clear to me that the speed and the ease in which the Taliban conquered Afghanistan is highly suspicious.
Very well. We're going to unfortunately leave it there. Thank you very much for that. Let me thank first the correspondent at the top of the spotlight, Alami, who spoke to us, writer, blogger, social activist, and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Sayyid Muaz Shah, spoke to us from Karachi. Thank you. And publisher and editor at Politics First, Marcus Papadopoulos from London. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kavit Tahwe, and the entire team, is goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أحبب حبيبك هونا ما عسى أن يكون بغيضك يوما ما وأبغض بغيضك هونا ما عسى أن يكون حبيبك يوما ما.
Imam Ali stated, "Have love for your friend up to a limit, for it is possible that he may turn into your enemy someday. And hate your enemy up to a limit, for it is possible that he may turn into your friend someday." Thank you. Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the beautiful things which we learn, and really the profound things which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, is the fact that he loved plain food. He loved to be simple. Now, of course, we find in the historical texts and we find in the books of tradition and both in the Sunni school of thought as well as the Shia school of thought that Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, lived a very simple life. And even despite being in a position where he was the leader of the whole Muslim Ummah, over this vast government and this vast authority which he had upon the Muslims and the Muslim lands, we find that he lived a very simple life. And one of the things which is a part of this simple life is the fact that he loved plain food. He used to be satisfied with food that was very simple. I'm sure most of you have heard the very famous stories of the dry bread which Imam Ali used to eat, or in the holy month of Ramadan, where he would only have one or two dishes at the most. For example, either bread with salt or bread with milk. But it is interesting when his daughter Umm Kulthum at one time invited him for the iftar, for the breaking of the fast in the evening in the holy month of Ramadan, and she put perhaps three things or four things, but what things? Not, you know, lamb chops and mutton and you know, things like that. No, she probably put milk and bread and yogurt and salt in front of the commander of the believers, the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam. And in response, Imam Ali says to his daughter, "When have I eaten more than one or two things at a time?" He used to love simple food. He used to be happy and satisfied with simple food. Dear friends, if it is difficult for us to be able to live that kind of a life, in the least we shouldn't live an extravagant life. We shouldn't live a life in which we are eating so much that we feel like our stomach is about to explode. Eat simple, live simple, be happy, be satisfied, be content. Beautiful lessons brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.